So if you look at the data, the median sale price for a home in Manhattan right now is like $1.3 million, which is a nice clean number. And it is also entirely useless, completely meaningless. I mean, trying to use a single median price to understand Manhattan real estate is, it's like trying to calculate the average speed of traffic in a city where, half the people are flying helicopters and the other half are stuck on a broken subway.
Right.
The math is technically correct, but it gives you absolutely no actionable information about how to actually navigate the terrain.
And navigating that terrain is exactly our mission for today's deep dives. We are taking a massive stack of data. Specifically, we've got this really extensive June 2026 joint analysis by the American newspaper and American TV, and we're like decoding the hidden social and capital map of Manhattan.
Which is fascinating. Yeah, because whether you are an aspiring buyer trying to make sense of the market, or a wealth manager trying to understand the psychology of your clients, or even if you're just intensely curious about how the world's most famous island actually operates behind closed doors, you have to understand one thing right out of the gate. Manhattan is not a single real estate market.
No, not even close.
Yeah.
It is a highly, highly layered ecosystem. I mean, people are not just paying millions of dollars for drywall and square footage here. They are paying wildly different premiums for scarcity, for prestige, for specific conveniences.
Yeah.
And honestly, in some of the most elite circles, they are paying for the power to keep other people out.
Which is wild. So we are going to break this island down today by neighborhood, by lifestyle, resident class, and most importantly, by investment value. Let's establish the core framework we're looking at here from the report. The data basically divides the island into these distinct zones. So downtown, midtown, and uptown. And it makes this fascinating argument about class structure. It basically argues that when you buy a piece of property in Manhattan, you are buying a specific identity.
That is the central thesis, yeah. You're buying an identity, you're buying into a specific social network, and you're buying a highly calibrated lifestyle.
Right.
And what's so revealing about this 2026 data is how it shows different types of wealth valuing, well, completely different sets of amenities. So, for example, legacy wealth, what we traditionally call old money, they gravitate toward discretion. They want immediate access to Central Park. They want to be within walking distance of, long-standing cultural institutions. And they actively seek out buildings with incredibly strict co-op boards.
Because they want that control.
Exactly, extreme control over who their neighbors are.
And then you contrast that with what the analysis calls new money, right?
Right. New money often just skips the park entirely. They
Yeah.
skew toward downtown lofts with massive volume or these brand new glass condos where they can get full hotel style
Yeah.
services,
Oh, yeah.
global architecture,
Yeah.
and total anonymity without having to, submit to a board interview. Meanwhile, you have young professionals whose entire purchasing logic is dictated by like subway liquidity and nightlife access.
Makes sense.
And then families who are making million-dollar decisions based almost entirely on school zoning and access to predictable, quiet residential rhythms.
So it sounds like Manhattan is essentially a giant VIP club, but instead of one velvet rope, there are dozens of different rooms, and each room has a completely different dress code and currency.
That is a perfect analogy.
But okay, I understand the lifestyle differences. Like, it makes sense that a 20-something tech founder wants a different vibe than a 60-year-old banking executive, but I have to push back on this underlying premise a bit.
Okay, go ahead.
At the end of the day, regardless of whether you're buying a historic loft or a new glass tower, aren't these buyers ultimately looking for the exact same thing financially? Like, don't they all just want a solid asset that gives them a return on their investment?
You would think so, but return on investment means entirely different things depending on which of these buyers you're talking about. The mechanism of the investment completely shifts based on the buyer's net worth and, well, their ultimate goals.
How so? Give me an example of that.
Okay, take someone looking at an apartment in the financial district. For that buyer, ROI is strictly about cash flow and rental liquidity. They know there's this constant rotating supply of first-year banking analysts moving to the city.
Right. Kids fresh out of college who need to be near Wall Street.
Exactly. They need to rent an apartment within walking distance of the office. So the buyer gets a unit, rents it out, and collects the yield. It is a highly liquid transactional investment.
Got.
But for the ultra-high net worth individual buying a property in, say, the West Village, ROI has absolutely nothing to do with cash flow or rental income. They aren't looking to flip the property, and they certainly aren't dealing with
Oh,
tenants.
for sure not.
For them, ROI is about wealth preservation and social gating.
So they are basically just parking capital.
They're parking $10, $20, or $40 million in an asset that they know is incredibly scarce.
Mm.
They're using the property as a vault, basically, to protect their capital against inflation while simultaneously buying into a specific cultural cachet.
Wow.
They don't care if it takes 6 months to find a buyer if they ever decide to sell, because they aren't relying on that money for liquidity.
That actually perfectly bridges us into the absolute pinnacle of that scarcity premium, which is downtown. The data highlights neighborhoods like Tribeca, the West Village, Soho, and NoHo. And, I mean, the numbers attached to these areas are staggering.
Oh, they're astronomical.
We are talking about West Village townhouses on intimate, tree-lined streets, places like Bleecker, Perry, or Charles Street, commanding anywhere from $10 to $40 million. And in Tribeca, prime lofts in buildings like 56 Leonard or 443 Greenwich run from $3 to $8 million, with trophy units easily clearing $10 million.
And look at who is buying them. The resident profile down there is this mix of founders, celebrities, media moguls, and what the analysts categorize as UHNW privacy buyers.
Ultra high net worth.
Right. Ultra high net worth individuals who actually want to remain completely invisible. And you have Soho and NoHo, which trade on these massive 19th century cast iron lofts and this unmatched street level brand energy.
Even with all the tourists.
Well, yeah, that's the trade off there. You're dealing with incredibly crowded, tourist heavy retail corridors right outside your front door.
Okay, here is where I get stuck though. Let's look at the actual mechanism of value here. Why is a billionaire willing to pay $40 million for a small, aging 19th century brownstone with narrow staircases, or an old industrial building in Tribeca, when they could take that exact same money and buy a flawlessly engineered brand new glass penthouse
with every modern convenience imaginable?
Exactly. Like, why buy the creaky old house?
It comes down to a concept called cultural scarcity.
Okay.
Let's look at the mechanics of real estate development for a second. If you have enough capital, you can build a towering glass condo anywhere on earth. You can build it in Dubai, you can build it in London, you can build it in Miami.
Right.
You can engineer luxury and you can mass produce convenience. But what you absolutely cannot engineer is history.
You can't fake a 150-year-old neighborhood.
Precisely. You cannot replicate a cobblestone street that was laid down a century and a half ago. You cannot manufacture the authentic bohemian turned affluent aura of a West Village block.
It's just baked in.
It is. The cultural history is completely finite. There are only so many cast iron buildings in Soho. They aren't making any more of them. And when something is entirely finite, yet highly desired by the global elite, it converts from just being a nice place to live into one of the most durable financial assets on the planet. It is the ultimate defensive asset.
You know, it's like buying a rare vintage Rolex.
Oh, that's a good comparison.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, it might not keep time as perfectly as a modern Apple Watch. You might have to wind it manually, and it might cost a fortune to service. But you are buying the history, the craftsmanship, the story. You're buying an asset whose value is locked in its unreproducibility.
That is a perfect way to look at it.
But what happens when a buyer has that kind of capital, but they absolutely refuse to deal with the metaphorical manual winding of a vintage Rolex? Like, what if they want luxury, but they want zero friction? Where does that capital go?
That capital goes straight to Midtown. This is where the entire value proposition of the real estate shifts from historic scarcity to engineered convenience.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about master planned infrastructure. Places like Hudson Yards on the far west side, or the Time Warner and Deutsche Bank Center around Columbus Circle.
Yeah.
These are essentially vertical cities.
And the pricing definitely reflects that. Trophy condos in these areas easily clear $8 to $10 million, and significantly more if you have unobstructed park or river views.
Yes, but what you are paying for is the infrastructure. You have hotel condo living, globally recognized architecture, high-end retail, and fine dining without ever having to even leave your building.
The ultimate bubble.
Exactly. You don't have to worry about the plumbing of a 150-year-old brownstone. If something breaks, the building management fixes it before you even notice it's broken.
So the buyer profile here is a complete 180 from the discreet media founder hiding out in a cobblestone alley in the West Village.
Completely different. Midtown, especially areas like Midtown East and Nomad, is built for corporate convenience. It attracts commuters, executives, diplomats, and a massive amount of global capital looking for a pied-à-terre.
Right, second or third home.
Right. These are international investors who want to fly into the city, have everything perfectly managed by the building staff, be close to their corporate offices or Broadway, and then just fly out.
But reading through the analysis, it seems like this engineered convenience is actually a double-edged sword. The data points out some severe vulnerabilities in the Midtown market.
It does, and the mechanics of why it's vulnerable are really fascinating. The very things that make Midtown convenient also make it highly fragile during economic shifts. The analysis specifically flags office cycle exposure.
Meaning if people aren't in the office, the neighborhood suffers.
Exactly. When corporate rhythms change, for example, a massive shift toward remote work or a downturn in the financial sector Midtown feels the impact faster and harder than anywhere else because its entire ecosystem is tied to the corporate workday.
And the report calls this ultra-luxury product liquidity sensitive. What does that actually mean in practice? Like, why does a $15 million glass box in Hudson Yards lose liquidity faster than a $15 million townhouse downtown?
Because of who is buying it. Think about the organic life of a neighborhood. In the West Village, you have local families, long-term residents, people whose entire lives are rooted in that specific community. They always need a place to live, regardless of what the stock market is doing.
Sure.
Midtown, on the other hand, relies heavily on transient crowds, hotels, and foreign investors. In a global economic downturn, that foreign capital vanishes overnight. The corporate executives stop flying in.
Oh, wow.
And suddenly you are trying to sell a $15 million glass box in an area that lacks organic neighborhood street life to a buyer pool that is completely dried up.
Yeah.
That is what it means to be liquidity sensitive.
Okay, so you have downtown's historic edge and finite scarcity, and you have Midtown's engineered but potentially fragile convenience. Let's move uptown. Because when we cross into the Upper East and Upper West Sides, the entire atmosphere shifts again.
Oh, entirely.
We are entering the realm of family wealth, legacy, and what the analysis calls community depth.
We're crossing into the old money axis. On the east side, you have this legendary corridor of Fifth Park and Madison Avenues. These are the iconic pre-war buildings. Core pricing here might sit in a broad band between $900,000 and $3 million. Mm-hmm. But the trophy homes in the elite buildings run from $5 million up to $50 million and beyond.
And this is where the notorious Manhattan Co-op Board really flexes its muscles. The data emphasizes that these uptown neighborhoods are heavily dominated by pre-war co-ops. Now, since you don't actually own real estate, when you buy into a co-op, you are just buying shares in the building's corporation and you get a proprietary lease. That board holds all the cards.
All of them.
They have to approve your purchase. They can scrutinize your finances. They can reject you for almost any reason.
They hold every card, and their scrutiny is absolutely legendary.
Okay, here is my genuine pushback on this. Wait, you're telling me a billionaire intentionally chooses a restrictive Upper East Side co-op where a board can dictate if they're allowed to own a dog or what months they're allowed to renovate their kitchen just for downside protection?
Yeah.
That makes no sense to me. If I have $50 million, I want total freedom. I want a condo where I can do whatever I want. I'm not submitting to a real estate HOA on a massive power trip.
I mean, it's easy to view them as just gatekeepers on a power trip. But you have to look at the financial mechanism behind the gatekeeping. Think of a strict co-op board, not as an HOA, but as a corporate poison pill or a permanent bank stress test.
A stress test?
How so?
When a co-op board demands that a buyer have three times the purchase price in liquid assets after closing, and when they ban pied à terre, and when they refuse to allow buyers to finance more than 20% of the purchase, or sometimes they demand all cash, they are creating a defensive moat around the building's finances. Ah, so they are guaranteeing that no matter what happens in the broader economy, nobody in that building is going to default on their monthly maintenance.
Exactly. They actively prevent flipping, and they completely insulate the building from interest rate shocks. They don't want transient investors. They want heavily capitalized permanent residents. By forcing every single buyer to pass this extreme financial stress test, they keep operating costs highly stable.
Wow.
Yes, the appreciation of that apartment might be slower than a flashy new downtown condo, but the downside protection is ironclad. If another 2008-style financial crisis hits, that co-op is barely going to feel it. It is wealth preservation executed with military discipline.
That completely flips my perspective on it. You aren't paying for freedom. You are paying for the certainty that your neighbors are as financially bulletproof as you are.
Precisely.
But Uptown isn't just the Upper East and Upper West Sides. The data intentionally guides us further north to Harlem and Washington Heights, showing how the map expands into incredible cultural and space value plays.
This is a crucial part of the ecosystem. You cannot understand Manhattan without understanding Harlem. It offers immense historic Black cultural capital.
Yeah, the roots there are so deep.
Unbelievably deep. It is anchored by institutions like the Apollo Theater and its proximity to Columbia University. The real estate market there features beautifully restored brownstones, trading between $2 and $5 million. These properties offer a scale, a volume, and an architectural beauty that would cost triple that amount if you picked it up and dropped it in the West Village.
And then even further north, you have Washington Heights. The analysis highlights the incredible Dominican and immigrant energy up there, the access to massive parks like Fort Tryon and the Cloisters, and the high elevation of the geography itself. It is a genuine space value play.
It really is. With a core price band of $400,000 to $1.2 million, it attracts a completely different demographic. You have medical professionals from the nearby Columbia Presbyterian Hospital system, artists, young families.
Makes total sense.
They're making a calculated trade-off. They're willing to accept a longer subway commute to Lower Manhattan in exchange for actual square footage, proximity to green space, and a vibrant neighborhood fabric.
Which brings us to what might be the most important part of this entire deep dive. How do the smartest buyers actually underwrite a purchase? Because the data establishes a very clear investment playbook based on this framework. And I find this fascinating because even if you aren't shopping for a $10 million townhouse, this framework applies literally anywhere in any city.
It does. The foundational rule they outline is so simple. Do not buy only the neighborhood's name. Buy the block.
Buy the block, not the brand.
Exactly. The analysis explicitly warns that a mediocre apartment in a world-famous neighborhood can, and often does, significantly underperform a superior apartment in an improving, less fashionable district. You cannot just rely on a zip code to do the heavy lifting for your investment.
Let's put this to the test. Let's say I have a budget of $5 million. I can either buy a heavily compromised, dark, first-floor unit in a prime Tribeca building, or I can buy an absolutely stunning, top-floor, sun-drenched, historic brownstone up in Washington Heights. How do I actually run that through this framework to make the smart choice?
You have to test both properties against three specific metrics: scarcity, liquidity, and operating cost.
Okay.
Let's start with scarcity. Is what you are buying hard to reproduce? A dark first-floor unit in Tribeca is not inherently scarce. It's just in a scarce neighborhood. But a top-floor, historically intact brownstone with unobstructed light is deeply scarce, regardless of where it is.
Okay, so Washington Heights wins on scarcity in this hypothetical. What about liquidity?
Liquidity asks, will there be natural buyers for this specific unit, even in a weak market? If the market crashes, the pool of buyers willing to overpay for a dark, compromised apartment in Tribeca shrinks to zero.
Because nobody actually wants it.
Right. But a beautifully renovated, spacious family home near major hospitals and parks will always have a baseline of local demand. People always need homes.
And the third metric, operating cost. Because this is the silent killer of real estate investments.
It is the ultimate silent bleed. Those monthly common charges in a flashy new glass tower or a poorly managed building can quietly drain your equity over a decade. If that Tribeca building has high assessments for luxury amenities you don't even use, your operating costs will destroy your yield.
Ouch.
Whereas a well-run building up north, even if the appreciation is slower, might keep your carrying costs remarkably stable. The framework forces you to ask, are you buying into hype or are you buying into durable infrastructure? Are you buying transit access, established parks, and true cultural permanence? Or are you just buying a trendy zip code?
So it's about understanding the underlying mechanics of value, stripping away the marketing, and looking at the structural integrity of the asset.
That is the only lens through which you can safely view real estate.
We have covered a massive amount of ground today. We started in the scarcity-driven cobblestone lofts of Tribeca and the West Village, where history and unreproducibility command an astronomical premium. We moved into the perfectly engineered, highly convenient, yet liquidity-sensitive global capital hubs of Hudson Yards and Midtown. We unpacked the heavily gate-kept, old-money fortresses of the Upper East Side co-ops, discovering how those boards act as the ultimate financial stress tests. And we explored the profound cultural depth and space value plays of Harlem and Washington Heights. It is crystal clear that Manhattan is far less a single real estate market and much more a collection of highly specific, almost tribal microeconomies.
It is a mosaic of entirely different currencies. And as we wrap up, I want to leave you with a final thought to ponder. It's something that builds directly on a very subtle detail buried in the geographical data of the analysis.
Oh, what's that?
Throughout the breakdown, it notes specific topographical advantages, For the financial district downtown, it repeatedly highlights the premium buyers pay for water views. But for Washington Heights, way up at the top of the island, it specifically values the high elevation.
Right, because it sits on a massive bluff overlooking the river.
Exactly. Right. So as we look 10, 20, or 50 years into the future, consider how the very definition of scarcity and luxury might fundamentally change. When global climate realities and rising sea levels truly begin to exert physical pressure on coastal cities, how will that alter the capital map?
Wow.
Could we see a future where high ground becomes the ultimate unreproducible premium? Could climate realities eventually flip the entire value map of Manhattan completely upside down, making the bluffs of Washington Heights the most coveted defensive luxury assets on the island, while the water views downtown become a liability?
Now that is a massive paradigm shift. Imagine the entire VIP club flipping its layout, where the velvet ropes move from the cobblestones of Tribeca all the way up to the bluffs of the Heights.
It could happen.
And it circles right back to where we started. That simple $1.3 million median price tells you absolutely nothing about the actual story of a city. Whether you are looking at Manhattan, London, or your own hometown, you have to look past the average.
Absolutely.
I hope you take this decoder ring, this new lens of class, scarcity, and infrastructure, and apply it to the neighborhood maps in your own life. Because the real value is never just in the square footage. It's in the story the streets are telling and the mechanics of how that city actually works. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive, and we'll catch you next time.